Hello and welcome to the Dyslexia Quest, where we come together as a community and delve into the inquiry of the power of the dyslexic mind via conversations with experts on all sorts of topics, including individual differences and education, human flourishing, optimized learning environments, and the dyslexic strengths. I'm Ellie Sheva-Schwartz, your host, and I hope you enjoy the conversations and this broader inquiry as much as I do. And now, on to the show. It is another wonderful day questing together with all of you guys on the Dyslexia Quest podcast. And today I have such a great interview with Barbara Steinberg. And Barbara Steinberg is the founder of PDX Reading Specialists. And she does teacher trainings where she's actually training teachers to know how to properly support dyslexic students. She's doing such interesting work, and we had such a fascinating conversation. And in this conversation, she gives a template to parents that they can use to structure a conversation to have with the teachers at the beginning of the year. And I want you guys to listen for this template so you guys can jot down a few notes so that you'll be most prepared for in about half a year or so when everybody gets back to school, so you'll know how to start the year off on a really fantastic footing. And Barbara's story actually begins in the classroom as a teacher. She was born to teach, and after 12 years, she was still as passionate and committed as ever, but year after year, she'd lie awake at night thinking about the 4 or 5 students who were bright and eager to learn, yet struggled with the basics of reading, writing, and spelling. She worried about these kids and was frustrated because she didn't have the appropriate knowledge or tools to help them out. What she knows now that she didn't know then, that all these students were dyslexic, and Barbara's search for answers on how to help these students led her to graduate school to study language-based reading disabilities, and her intention was to use this newfound knowledge and apply it in the classroom. But over time, it became clear that dyslexic learners and their families that supported them needed a mentor and a guide. So she founded PDX Reading Specialties, and it was founded with a mission to create confident and capable learners. And they've helped hundreds of students overcome the various challenges associated with dyslexia through remediation. And equally important, they've inspired remarkable individuals to discover their hidden gifts and become self-advocates. So Barbara really breaks down for me how we can support these students and some of the very interesting work she's doing with teachers. And I know you guys will love this one as much as I did. And now, moving on, we are doing the very exciting review of the week. And you guys know the spiel. The reason that these reviews are so important is because every time you leave a rating or review in iTunes, it helps the people that are logging on the internet looking for this kind of resource. The moms and the dads and the guardians that are lost out there and are looking for some information, they're looking for some community, they're looking for some other families, it helps them find it because it helps our search engine optimization and it helps the podcast come up on Google searches. But also lately, more and more, what I've really just been finding a lot of strength and direction in reflecting on the reviews. I'd go onto the review page and it helps me understand why I wake up and do what I do. It helps me understand the people that are consuming this content. Sometimes it feels like I'm just talking into a computer. It's hard for me to imagine that there are people on the other side. I see the stats, but it's hard for me to realize that those numbers are actual human beings and families. So as always, I love when you reach out to me, when you email me. Find me on Instagram at The Dyslexia Quest and on Facebook, Ellie Sheva-Schwartz. And now onto this wonderful conversation. And as always, happy questing. So hi, Barbara, and welcome to The Dyslexia Quest.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So I'm really excited to talk to you about your journey, how you got into doing the work that you're doing, and how you support families. And I know that you started your journey as a teacher and in the classroom. And when I was doing my research and I was hearing you talk about your students and your experience being a teacher, it left me really envious that I didn't have you as a teacher because you sound like an amazing teacher. And I was so present to your love and your care for the students that were falling between the cracks. So take us back to the beginning of the story. When did you begin thinking about ideas like dyslexia or learning differences or multiple intelligences? What's the backstory?
Well, first of all, I have to say that even though I'm not in a classroom, I'm still 100% a teacher. And I've never lost my love of classroom teaching. And I think that what I'm doing professionally, primarily now working with teachers, allows me to, in a way, impact so many students much differently than I did in the past. But my heart is still in the classroom. And actually, my professional journey, I think, started as a student myself. I was never diagnosed dyslexic or ADHD, but as one of my former colleagues said to me, you're definitely not neurotypical. And I don't know that any of us are quote unquote normal, but my not being neurotypical, I think always left a soft spot in my heart for those who were really smart and worked their tails off and yet were struggling. And those were the students that I loved the most and thought about the most because for some reason there was a huge disconnect for them. And I just couldn't figure out why that was. Why, when I would read a book to them aloud, they could engage in really sophisticated conversation and their oral language skills were tremendous and their interpersonal skills were remarkable for their maturity and age. And yet, when I looked at their writing, it just wasn't representative of their intellect. And certainly, I couldn't wrap my head around the spelling errors. And it wasn't until a colleague suggested that maybe they were dyslexic. And I really scoffed and thought, what are you talking about? They're not reversing their B's and D's. And mind you, I had already been a classroom teacher by that point for 10 years. I had my master's degree, and that was my understanding of dyslexia. And she handed me the book Overcoming Dyslexia, which at that time, this is 2008, at that time was the iconic text and the brain research, the science about the reading brain. And as I read it, I really had this mixture of emotions. It was an absolute aha moment for me when all of those kids who had come in the years through my classroom, their faces came flashing back, and I just felt such tremendous guilt for not having reached them in a way that worked for their brain. And while my intentions were genuine, I think that my message to them was just, come on, try, you'll get it. Just try harder. And that's a horrible thing to have to live with, knowing that they were trying hard. It was I who didn't understand how their brain works. And so that book really opened up the floodgates for me in terms of my own learning. And because I live on the West Coast, there were no universities that had classes in dyslexia. I mean, it was not even a word talked about. And so I started pursuing my own professional development, came across an incredible dean of education at a university here in Portland who was willing to coach me and support me through another master's degree that focused on language-based reading disabilities. And I intended to go back to the public school classroom. I was a product of public schools. I felt like my own personal education. I still have some pretty horrible memories of being in the late bird reading group because I was behind. My professional experience was in public school and private school, but I felt like that was where I needed to be and I needed to be able to help these kids. But as soon as I came back with this newfound knowledge and excitement about how the brain reads and why we need explicit systematic instruction and, about dyslexia, that nobody wanted to hear it. Not only did they not want to hear it, they didn't want me talking about it. And that was mind-blowing to me because here we are in, 2010, and we've had the science of dyslexia for years. We've had methodologies that have worked for these individuals for years. We know that if teachers can understand their inherent struggles, they can empower and inspire these kids to achieve even in the face of tremendous obstacles. And nobody wanted to hear it. And so I made a really difficult decision to leave the classroom, which, like I said, was such a part of my identity. And my mission was to help kids. And I did. And I loved it. But it became clear that I could only help one child at a time. So how can I help lots of children at a time? And the answer was to get in front of those teachers. And in partnering with Decoding Dyslexia, we got legislation passed, and that legislation allowed me to train teachers, and that's what I do. And I just finished yesterday another cohort of educators who are having those same aha moments and are equally furious. Why didn't I receive this training in my preparation program? And so that is where I'm at. And I hope that, 10 years from now, I will be in any school in any town USA, and dyslexia will not be this word that is so misunderstood.
Yeah, from your lips to God's ears.
Right?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm sure there are people that are listening to this podcast and they're a little stunned that there could be a teacher that got her degree in teaching, was in the educational system teaching for 10 years, and still knew almost nothing about dyslexia. And I guess it, continuing on that question, kind of attached to that question is also, what was happening when you wanted to talk about dyslexia and you came back to the school with all this information that people didn't want to hear? Like, I'm sure there are parents that are listening to this and they're just so confused and frustrated. What's going on over here?
Yeah. And because I always teach, or I always keep the teacher hat on first, I want to make sure that parents understand teachers are well-intentioned, that we want to do what's best for kids, but we don't always know how. And we certainly aren't supported by the administration and by the policymakers. And so when I came back with this, information, I really believe that the reason for not accepting it as an absolute truth, right, the science that it is, has to do with a couple of things. Long-held beliefs about what people believe is the way children learn to read. That's one thing. So the conflict between those who believe you learn through exposure alone. And then, of course, the reality that the minute we acknowledge something, we have to then deal with it. And that becomes a big financial obstacle. And those two things continue to be the root cause of not recognizing dyslexia in general.
Yeah. And what's happening on the university level that it's not talked about? I mean, I would think that that would be like a significant percentage of the curriculum would be talking about, hey, you're trying to teach, second and third graders. You should keep an eye out for, learning differences and dyslexia specifically.
Yeah. Well, and sure, teacher preparation programs, right, are the foundation of a teacher's understanding about how to teach, and not just reading, but in general. And unfortunately, whether it's here in Oregon or anywhere in the U.S., teacher preparation programs have just not been deep enough in the area of literacy acquisition to give teachers the background information they need to teach reading explicitly. Now, when I say teach reading, I'm talking about the technical lower level skills needed to teach how to break words apart. Reading as this big complex process also has this huge area of comprehension skills. That's a whole different area of reading instruction that also has to be explicitly taught to educators. And there just isn't enough time in a teacher preparation program to go deep enough. We're talking about linguistics, right? We're talking about speech and language skills. And until the teacher preparation programs are able to add these component pieces, we're going to continue to send educators out into the field without the proper training and skills. And that, I think, is one of the greatest frustrations of the educators who are receiving training now after having been in the classroom for 10, 20, 30 years, is that they look at the new teachers coming out and nothing has changed. Now, I can't speak to every state, but specifically here in Oregon, one of the components of the legislation that was passed charged the Teachers and Practices Commission with having the university programs embed those component pieces into their teacher preparation programs. So that is happening right now. The universities are figuring out how to add that to the preparation programs without obviously extending the length of the training program.
Amazing.
Teachers can't afford to go to school for 5 years to come out and have just a teacher, right, credential or master's.
Yeah.
So it's a big obstacle, but it is the one that is going to be addressing this at the root.
Amazing. So
yeah.
take me into the room with the teachers and the teacher training that you're doing. What are you hearing from the teachers is their biggest pain point with these students? Is it that they're just like, I don't know how to reach this child and help him flourish? Is it that there are so many different children in the classroom that have different learning needs? What's the real pain point for these teachers?
Well, there's a couple. I mean, I always say that surrounding whatever academic deficits a student might have, right, whether it's dyslexia or any other struggle, we have the social emotional profile. And that social emotional profile, whatever anxiety that child's feeling or whatever feelings they have about themselves as a learner or school, they take precedent to any kind of academic challenge. And unless we can address those, it doesn't matter how incredible the teacher we are, what curriculum we have, even if we have an hour of one-on-one time with every student. So the real question is, how do we empower teachers to, in turn, empower their students to start to appreciate that just because this is difficult for you does not mean that you are not smart? And that's really where that multiple intelligences piece comes in. And so a large part of the training has to do with, what can I do tomorrow that's going to make an exponential difference in this child's life? Because we know that while academic interventions are absolutely essential to close the gap, that progress doesn't happen overnight, right? That's like a slow journey to making progress. But what we can do is influence a child's social emotional understanding and well-being by simply changing our language, including accommodations in the classroom, and really for an educator to just understand completely what this child's experiencing on an academic basis and on a social emotional basis.
Amazing. So to the parents that are listening to this that are like, yeah, I wish the teacher that was working with my student understood all of this, and they're curious about how to start a dialogue with the teachers, and they want to show the teacher how much they appreciate the work that they're doing, and they want to show the teacher that they understand that this is a really difficult job, but at the same time, they see that their child's needs are not being addressed, and they might see their child really suffering. How do parents go ahead and navigate this sometimes difficult terrain? I mean, I hear a lot of parents that are saying, I know my teacher needs to do X, Y, and Z, but I'm so nervous to talk about it because I don't want to be that mom that everybody in the school is talking about that's like too loud and bossy and everybody hates. Or the opposite, the parent that is just, you know, that is just so pained that their child is suffering that, you know, sends the emails, picks up the phone, and then the teacher feels attacked and feels like there's this hostility, this us against them mentality.
Yeah, and you've hit it on the head, is that the relationship is foundational, right? Parents are partners, and I think that the parent who's coming in, who often is holding a lot of emotional baggage for their child, or it could even be from themselves, right, in their own personal experience coming back as a student. But to move the dial forward in the direction that everybody wants it to go, they have to put that aside and approach it from a collaborative standpoint, in spite of whatever frustrations they're feeling about their school. And I think one of the best ways to do that is with a beginning of the year letter. And that beginning of the year letter could be, "Dear so-and-so, I want to tell you a little bit about my child." And starting with their strengths, starting with their challenges, these are the things we're doing at home to support them. And these are the things that would be so helpful if you could support, you know, our child. And if you need a template for a letter, I have them available, lots of them on my website. Under the resources section, it's www.pdxreadingspecialist.com.
And we'll link it up in the show notes. So Erica, as you're listening to this, and for those of you who don't know, Erica is my producer and she's amazing. Erica will link it up in the show notes and it will link right over on your website.
And that beginning of the year letter, especially starting with, you know, these are my child's strengths and these are what we're doing and we want to partner with you. And there's a section in there that is, if there is a diagnosis and we know that your child is dyslexic, and I'd love to tell you a little bit about dyslexia because I bet other students are struggling. And it opens the door with a call to action of, if you'd like to learn more. And then there are some links to videos and books. And it's really an invitation for that teacher. And I hope that, you know, teachers are supposed to model lifelong learning. And so it's my hope that a teacher, when approached in a way that is not threatening, will take that as a, you know, when the bait is offered, take it. And it only takes watching one of those movies or videos on YouTube or reading one book for you to have that aha moment, and then progress is moving at a rapid pace. It's that initial hurdle. And the challenge is that to admit that you don't know something is difficult regardless. But for teachers who are supposed to be experts, when they are called to the carpet in a way that they feel threatened, the wall goes up. And it's not their fault they don't know. So it's our job as parents and, you know, fellow practitioners to say, we grant you permission to, you know, and forgiveness. You don't know this because you didn't learn it in your teacher prep program. But 1 in 5, right? That means in your class, there's probably 4 or 5 students who are struggling with this. Here's where you can learn more. And the resources are out there. There's, you know, a proliferation now of sites and fantastic YouTube videos.
Yeah.
And that's the first step.
Yeah. I also think sometimes it's hard for adults and for teachers to remember the power difference is so tremendous from like a second grader to a teacher that sometimes the littlest comments that you're saying, you might not realize that they're landing as hurtful. Like, just try a little harder. You might think that that's really encouraging because you're teaching them to be gritty and resilient. But for a child that is trying their best and that really wants you to know that they're trying the best and really wants you to know that they're smart, when you say just try a little harder, that could be the thing that then is the child understands it as, oh, she's being so mean to me. I'm not trying so hard enough. And I hear this going on all the time where kids tell their parents, so-and-so teacher, she's so mean, I hate her. And the parents meet the teacher and she's sweet and she's trying her best and she doesn't even realize that a little comment like try a little harder for that kid at that moment, there was like, in their mind, there was like, there's nothing else I can do. And she wants me to be at a certain level. And so she becomes mean because she wants me to be at a certain level that I can't be at. And to the adults, it might be, they might have missed that moment because it happens so quickly.
Yes.
But to the child, they're like, I hate her. She's so mean. And that's because she's the authority figure and she's the person that they're trying to impress and she's the person that the child is trying to figure out their okayness, like how successful and okay they are all around her or him.
That's exactly it. And I mean, you've touched on a couple of things. One is, it's almost this vicious cycle of, okay, if I work really hard and I accomplish success, then I get that positive reinforcement of from a teacher of, I knew you could do it, right? And here's something more. And now the bar's been raised. And so you're constantly in this rat race of trying to keep your head above water. And the second thing is that that comment, which has no intention of being, you know, insensitive, is often received much differently. And this is because one of the strengths of a dyslexic learner, and this is a gross generalization, is that they have high emotional IQ. And they're able to intuit human emotion with an uncanny ability. And because of that, they pick up on comments and nonverbal communication more acutely than potentially other students. And so that comment of, I know you can do it, right, takes on this life of its own that the teacher didn't intend, but that's how it's received. And at the end of the day, it doesn't matter what was said, it's what was heard, especially when we're talking about children. You know, I've talked to lots and lots of successful dyslexic adults and those who have overcome their dyslexia. And the universal theme among them is that it wasn't their socioeconomic status that separates the successful from those who aren't as successful. It wasn't their tutor. It wasn't, you know, a variety of other environmental factors. It was that somewhere in their educational journey, they had a teacher who believed in them. That was the one strand that has been consistent. And if you can be that teacher, right, then it's everything else will fall into place. So that's a huge piece.
Yeah, absolutely. So I know you work supporting dyslexic students and their families. So take me to what you do with the shutdown learner. I don't know if you deal with homework with these kids, but I remember when I was in tutoring, I must have been in third or fourth grade, I did this thing where anytime the tutor said, so what are you learning in school today? Or what do you have for homework? For about a year, my curiosity was, how long can I say nothing? Nothing, nothing, nothing. And I was so angry at the world, but typically, like, statistically, it seems to be on average girls internalize their anger and frustration, and boys externalize their anger and frustration on average as a mass aggregate. So I was the typical internalizer. So I was struggling so much in school. And the way I was able to just have power or show my anger to the adults, I was going to be as uncooperative as possible. And the answer to everything was nothing. So
yep.
I don't know. Do you have
that's
any
a power play.
Yeah. Have you dealt with any of those students that are just opting out?
Well, so yes, working on homework would be a different ball of wax, right? Because you're asking this student who's clearly in educational therapy to probably do something that's above their level of success. And so you're setting them up for failure, okay? Fortunately, because we're working from a, you know, roots model, right? We're going back to the beginning and building up from there versus a homework tutor, which is working on things that are at the present level of what they're expected to do. The foundation of that is you achieve success before you move on. And so there's built-in positive reinforcement and gratification. Now, that doesn't mean that it's fun. That doesn't mean that we don't deal with kids who don't want to do it. Because who wants to work on something that is so difficult for them after the school day, right? And sometimes feels really babyish. And so there's a couple of things that, again, come back to a relationship. And the first one is having a relationship with a tutor that is the crux of success right there. Geography, time, location, all of those are secondary. There has to be a connection because kids don't learn from people they don't like. That's just the end, you know, of learning right there. But I think the bigger challenge is the kid who I work with and who comes to my office and feels like they're dumb. Their brain is broken. There's something wrong with them. That I see over and over and over again. Because when you start to not achieve success in school, one of two things happens. You either decide you hate school, you hate learning, this language is crazy, or you internalize there's something wrong with me.
Or you do both.
Or you do both. Exactly. Why not? And so, reframing and the way that I deal with it when I, consult with a kid and a family is I bring out a brain. We talk about a brain and talk about why reading is so hard. And guess what? It comes down to the fact that your brain was never even meant to read. And, we talk about it from a structural standpoint. We talk about their strengths and where they are on the right side of the brain and how working with them through tutoring is going to make this area of their brain have connections that aren't there right now. Because the cool thing about our brains is that we can rewire them. And so for some, it's this instant, oh my gosh, like this is amazing. And for some, it's a very skeptical, well, let's wait and see. But unlike potentially other tutoring approaches they've tried that they haven't necessarily achieved success, they start to see really quickly that they're learning. And they're learning in a way that works for their brain. And that's why they're learning. And you see the confidence start to improve. You see a kiddo who starts to, pick up a book on their own. Does it happen overnight? No. Does it take a lot of work? It sure does. And a lot of that work comes on that confidence, social emotional, built, breaking through whatever walls that child has already built up. And that is really the biggest argument for early intervention, because the older you are, the more walls you put up.
Yeah, absolutely. And I always tell people that it's so helpful to help children make sense out of what's going on in their experience. Because these kids are fully aware that the person sitting next to them to the left or the person sitting next to them to the right is having a much easier time with this skill acquisition, or their sister when they were in their grade 2 years earlier, or their neighbor, or whatever it is. The child is so clear that they are on average having more difficulty with these skills. And it's interesting because even if, as an outsider, you can see a student, you can say, you know what, they're keeping their head above water. Maybe they're getting 75s or 80s. I don't really think this is worrisome yet. It de really depends what the rest of their class is doing. So if everybody else in the class is getting an easy 100 and you're working hard to get an 80, even if maybe an 80 is fine, this child is still noticing. Everybody else can just breeze in and do the spelling bee or do the spelling questions, and it's so hard for me. So being able to give them that sense making is so helpful. I remember I got diagnosed with specific learning disability in third grade, and the only thing that was told to me is you're learning disabled. And so it was this like hush-hush thing that there was also this like you're learning disabled, but you don't want anybody to know because somehow your brain is less than everybody else. And it never really felt helpful. It just really felt shameful because it wasn't like, and here are the ways in which we can help you learn. It was like you're learning disabled, so you better go to a special ed classroom and throw, paper balls around at each other. So actually being able to help students know what's going on can really be the underlying thing that helps them understand why they're frustrating, and understanding will set you free. I'm a big believer in that.
Huge. And I'm so sorry for your experience, given that you're quite young and it's still happening,
You know
right?
what? I've had a lot of crazy experiences, and sometimes for about a minute I feel sorry for myself, and then I remember that if I would have had any of a better time in the educational system, maybe I would not be devoting my life to doing the work that I'm doing.
There you go.
So,
There's making lemonade from lemons. I love it.
no, but yeah, it really occurs to me that way because if I experienced it that way, then maybe there are some others that are still experiencing that way, and then we need to really shine a light on what's going on.
Yeah, but it brings up that whole question about labels, right? Because that term learning disabled, dis is the prefix for not being able to learn. And I think our understanding, and certainly in the professional circles, this realization that it is not disability, it is just a different ability. It's a difference in the way that your brain works. And that's why when I do assessment, I say that the greatest benefit and outcome of my assessment with a student is not to confirm whether or not they're dyslexic. I pretty much know going in that they're dyslexic. It's to be able to have an answer and to have a map of their brain, so to speak, so that we can tell the child, so that we can communicate that information to them and draw a map out for them. And that becomes the start of, their journey. But to be given a label with that doesn't give you any empowering information is useless.
Yeah, absolutely. So, what do you do with the students that, as you begin exploring accommodation with them, they say, it's embarrassing. I don't want to use the accommodation. None of my friends use the accommodations.
Well, I get this question all the time because the greatest obstacle to using accommodations is, in fact, an individual's own perception. They want to be, quote unquote, normal. Because, of course, who doesn't, right? I would say that one of the greatest changes in terms of just society is that the use of technology in elementary school classrooms has grown to the point that kids getting on a Chromebook and putting on headphones is not out of the norm, right? So, since so many accommodations are technology-based, it doesn't require looking different. That being said, when I present to a student the idea that they listen to their novel, their fourth grade novel, instead of read it, they still have a perception and a belief that that's cheating. And so reframing this idea that a book, right, is just a metaphor for learning, and that our goal is to just take what's in that book and either understand it as knowledge or, enjoy it if it's story. And how we get there can be totally different for each person. You could get there with your eyes, you can get there with your ears, you could get there with your finger. Now, why do most people choose to get there with their eyes? Because it is for them the fastest way. But for you, the fastest way and the way that's going to allow the best understanding is with your ears. If the end goal is the same, you could do it with your eyes, but it's going to take you a really long time and you may not understand it as well as you would if you listened to it. You can do it. But wouldn't this be so much easier? And I often will draw for kids, the image of a set of stairs and a ramp with a wheelchair at the bottom, and use that as a totally different metaphor. Can this individual in a wheelchair get up those stairs? Sure. They could go up, on their behind, pushing themselves, and it's going to be really long and arduous. Will they get there? Absolutely. But if they went up the ramp, couldn't they get there a lot easier and have time left over for the things that they love and enjoy? Reading a book is the same thing. And so, by stepping back and kind of widening the lens helps to change the mindset. But there's no doubt that the mindset of using audiobooks or using speech to text has this element of cheating is ingrained in teachers' minds, in society's mind, and it's my job, it's the job of everybody, you and everybody who works in this field, to work diligently to change those perceptions, because at the end of the day, the book is just a metaphor for learning. And these kids are not learning disabled. They have a reading challenge.
Yeah, or specific other school-related skills,
Exactly.
but yeah, and what's always been so confusing about the term learning disability, I remember being a really little kid in school thinking about that, is I always thought of myself as somebody that learned really easily. I just hated being in the classroom. But like the term just didn't resonate with me because I was like, I'm always learning. Like when I was sitting down on the couch with my dad and he was telling me stories about him growing up, like that was learning. Like learning disabled, it was just like I'm classroom disabled in this specific school, in this particular educational environment. Like that always seemed obvious to me, which is also getting back to the conversation around terminology and languaging. Not only can it be harmful because it's such a negative context, but it could also be harmful if it doesn't ring as true. So because it didn't ring as relevant at all, I was just like, this isn't applicable to me. And then I spent the rest of my educational environment trying to learn how to learn like everybody else.
And I think that it's important that we retain the language for legal reasons.
Yes, absolutely.
We don't want, you know, we want to remind people dyslexia is in the definition of IDEA, but in practice and when working with kids, we want to look at it as a learning difference. But we want to retain the actual language so that we don't lose the legal protections.
Yeah, absolutely. Really good point. Thank you for mentioning that. So imagine that you have a best friend and she has a son who just got his diagnosis of dyslexia, and she calls you and she says, Barbara, we just found out that our, let's just say our second grade son is dyslexic. And she gets on the phone with you and she says, what's it important for me to know going forward? What do you think is the most important lessons to know that you've seen dealing with the families and dealing with the parents that it's important for me to know now, prevented preemptively?
Great question. Especially because now getting online, you Google dyslexia and you're going to come up with a lot of great information, but there's a lot of fake news out there as well. And it becomes incredibly confusing for parents trying to navigate all that information. And so often when I get that call, it's two things. It's coming up with a tangible action plan, right? And that action plan is not just remediating a deficit. I always say it's a three-pronged approach. We need to figure out the best way to support this child from the bottom up, whether that is, you know, simultaneously multisensory instruction in reading and spelling, which is like the Orton-Gillingham method, handwriting, what does this child need based on the data? Then top down, how do we meet this child where they're at right now, at the point of performance, in the classroom, when the stakes are high, when they're sitting next to their peers? How do we level the playing field? So that conversation involves the school piece. Do we need to get a 504 in place? Do we, you know, go for special education? So it's that top down, bottom up. And then I always say surrounding all of those is the empowerment and inspiration. How do we communicate this information to your child in a way that it's going to be well received? And some parents are really great at being able to integrate language. They've been, you know, using this language for a long time of your brain just learns differently. And for a lot of parents, they're coming again, their own, because dyslexia, you know, has this genetic component, their own experiences come flooding back and it's highly emotional. And so when I often coach parents or I sit down and I'm coaching kids through this conversation, I rely on actually using picture books. And one of my favorite series, The Adventures of Everyday Geniuses, has these picture book stories that tell a story of a student who has a struggle and how they have overcome it. And the conversation is not a one and done, but it's a let's start talking and then what's the next step? And so using that three-pronged approach, I give parents kind of tangible action steps. And I say, this is step one, right? We're going to get step one going. And then it's step two. But there's a steep learning curve. And the learning curve cannot be, you can't sit down and digest everything that you want to know about dyslexia in one step. So here's your first step. You're going to read this fact sheet so that you at least can understand a little bit. And it's a gradual release model. And some parents require more handholding than others. And you know, that's part of what I do is individualize the instruction, not just for the kids, but also for the families, because it's a family affair.
Yeah. Yeah. It's also interesting from a parent's perspective, how as we get older, we automatically have so many compensatory skills that it sometimes we forget what it was like to be that, you know, second grader or third grader. Because it's interesting for me, because now I actually just audited a master's level class that I'm taking because I just finished this online course that I do for parents. It was very intense. It was 8 weeks. It's all about building self-esteem for dyslexic children. It was an amazing experience, but it was very intense. So now we're actually on break, and then January 2018, I'm starting the next season of the podcast. So I'm like, I'm going to do some things that I enjoy. So I'm auditing this class. It's a class at JTS, Jewish Theological Seminary, and it's a class on Kabbalistic thought and reincarnation. And
oh my gosh.
There was assigned readings on reincarnation in different religions. So I'm reading this book on like reincarnation in Hinduism, and I can't find a PDF because it's like some obscure thing. I can't find a PDF, and I'm Googling all the professors on the reading list to try to find their YouTube videos, because if I watch the YouTube video, then I'll get context. I'll hear them say their terms that they say over and over again, and then I look back at the book and I can figure it out. And I had this moment where it was like, it's been a long time since I've read something without any adult context on it. Because most of the books that I read these days, they have to do with the work that I'm doing. I'm so familiar with the background. The business world, so much of the vocabulary, I'm familiar with it. And to the point that I'm like, sometimes I wonder and I'm like, wow, I read that so easily. Am I really dyslexic? And then taking this course, I'm looking at this book. I can't find a PDF. I'm like, this is what it was like to be in second grade. Unfamiliar vocabulary, unfamiliar ideas. How often do we have unfamiliar ideas as an adult? We've heard so many of these ideas before.
Yeah.
We open up a book, we basically know what it's going to say. And I'm like, I read this book on reincarnation in Indian thought. I'm like, I have not a clue what I'm reading about. But if I heard him speak, I would get it. And it was so interesting to me because I was like, right, that's what I experienced when I was way younger. Because we forget when we have all these compensatory skills and our vocabulary has extended, and from the context we can know where things are going, that we forget that that underlying skill beneath it, just that raw decoding. And that's why I talk to parents all the time that say, you know, I had a difficult time reading, but now I love reading. And I ask them, what kind of books do they love reading? And they'll tell me that they love reading fiction or memoir. And those are the kind of genres that you can skim or misread words and you'll still get it. And then they'll say in nonfiction, they'll pick up a book and then they'll read the first chapter and skim the rest. Or they will read about the same topic that they're obsessed with and they've been reading about for years and years and years, and they basically know what the book is going to say. So that was such an interesting experience for me, and it really had me remember. I was like, right, this is
what it's like.
This is,
Yeah, and one of the things that I have teachers do in a professional development workshop is a simulation to give them that appreciation, because as they go through a workshop, right, as a professional, they're reflecting back on their own learning. And of course, there are lots of educators who are also dyslexic. But to do a simulation, if you learn to read and have no recollections of having any challenges, is eye-opening. And there's actually lots of parent simulations that occur for that exact reason, to give parents that appreciation so that they can empathize, because so often I'll sit with a family and one parent will have struggled in school and the other one is like, why can't you get that? And it's so meaningful to be able to relate to your kid or, you know, your student having had that experience. And how interesting that for you as an adult to try to learn something new, you're able to reflect back and say, well, this is how I'm able to be successful. And we're so lucky that dyslexic learners in general have so many strengths that they come to the table with. And oftentimes parents say, I don't think they're dyslexic. Like, he can read. And I say, well, of course, you know, all individuals can read to a certain point. The question is, how much effort is your second grader expending? Because it's like a duck on water. And if their feet are going at 200% below the surface, they're able to keep their head above water. But what happens when they get to fourth grade or eighth grade, when they are handed that textbook and it's filled with information they've never learned about? Then what? Then they're going to hit a wall. They're going to start to sink. And so it's not necessarily what they can do. A lot of it is how much effort is involved. Because unless those lower level skills become completely automatic, then those compensatory strategies, which work amazingly well when you are in second, third grade don't serve you as well as you get farther along in your academic career.
Yeah, such a good point. And that's why so many of these students you see are so fatigued also. They're so tired at the end of the day. They're so tired. When the weekends come, they're just like happy to take a chill or to rest as they get to like middle school or high school, because there's so much of an extra effort to do some of these specific tasks if they're not properly accommodated. So as we're wrapping up, I'm just curious, what's getting you really excited in the world of dyslexia and the work that you're doing? It might get a little chatty over here because my nanny just is walking through to go get my other son. They're going to be out the door in 1 second. This is New York City living over here. My 1.5-year-old is chatting. But what's getting you really excited in your work? What do you see as kind of the forefront or really animating question that is having you excited about the work that you're doing, or a curiosity that's at the edge of your mind that you're excited to figure out or implement?
Well, I will tell you that if you had said to me back in 2010, when I started working one-on-one with kids, that we would be where we're at today in 2017, I would not have believed you. Because, you know, the International Dyslexia Association had been around for 40 years at that point, and very little progress had been made. And then all of a sudden, parents started to collaborate, and change happened, and it spread like a virus.
Amazing, and right? And the internet.
Amazing.
I mean, I guess that's what you mean by parents coming together. Like, parents coming together and having the internet to bring them together.
To bring them together. And what they have done legislatively in 50 states is unbelievable. And it's been amazing to be a partner, at least here in Oregon, with the Dakota Dyslexia Chapter. So their work has just started, right? So now we want to go back, and we're talking at state level and certainly at a federal level. And now it's time to go for the big ask. And the big ask, in my point of view, is that the way we've taught reading in America has been largely based on personal beliefs, which has long been, you know, noted as these reading wars. We need to bring together the science of how kids learn to read with the art of teaching. And those two fields have been completely separate and distinct, and they have to merge. And they have to merge because we have to start to train educators in the science of how kids learn how to read, and move away from what we feel is best for kids. Because we know that what we feel is best for kids is not necessarily what is best for their brains. And what's good instruction for dyslexic learners, which represents up to 20% of the population, is good instruction for all learners. And so that's my big, you know, charge for the next, we'll call it, 2 years.
Amazing. And it's so inspiring and comforting to know that there are people like you that are out there fighting the good fight.
Likewise.
Awesome. So my last question that I have for you is, was there anything that I didn't ask that you're kind of thinking, like, I think this would be really helpful for her audience if she would have asked me a question about blank?
Well, I will say that, thank goodness for technology. If there are parents who live in a city where they don't have the resources, that certain the resources in terms of professional, you know, resources, that I certainly am available to consult with parents and give them a little bit of guidance if they feel lost. Because the educational system is overwhelming. And so if they need, you know, an advocate, a mentor to put it all together for them, that is possible now thanks to technology.
Amazing. So where can they find you? I mean, we'll link up to you on the website, but just say it anyways that we're here.
So my company's name is PDX. So it's Portland PDX Reading Specialist. And our phone number is 503-747-3491. My incredible assistant, Mandy, is always there to listen to your story and see if we can, you know, support you in any way. And with, you know, no charge, I'm happy to talk to any family and at least point them in the right direction.
Amazing. All right. So thank you so much for coming on the show, Barbara.
Thank you. Have a good one.
Hey, Questers. This is Erica, and I produce the podcast. Did you love this episode? Reach out to us on Instagram at The Dyslexia Quest. And remember, each week we'll release a new episode. So be sure to subscribe. Thanks so much for listening.